So what we're talking about today is congregant interactions. And for those of you that don't know who I am, and it doesn't really matter, but I have been a pastor since I was 19 years old, and I'm 59 currently. And so I'm holding on to that as long as I can because I'll be 60 in a few months. But so I've got 40 years of pastoral ministry under my belt. And in 2013, I began to do work to complete my bachelor's degree. And then in 2014, I began work on a master's degree in professional counseling. And so I am absolutely fascinated by human behavior. I just find it fascinating. And some of the things that I now know about human behavior, or think I know, maybe understand a little bit more, maybe I should say, I really wish that I would have known about when I was a young pastor. So my prayer is that there's some pastors that maybe will listen to the recording later, and if not, that's okay, but hopefully. So because part of what I'm doing today, when I submitted this to the executive office about even doing this workshop, my thought was to maybe talk a little bit more about why congregants interact like they do. Why do people get along like they do? And quite frankly, what is applying here in many cases will apply to, certainly it applies to marriages, and I do a lot of this kind of work in couples therapy that I do as a professional counselor. In 2018, I went solo practice. I own and practice at Keystone Christian Counseling and Life Coaching in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, which is part of the Pittsburgh metropolitan area. And so I do about 30 to 35 appointments per week. A lot of that is couples, a lot of that, and a good bit of it is individual. So I've just been very interested in how people interact with one another. And so what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to talk about some attachment styles and how that impacts us as one another and what we can do and how we can apply this to people who attend our churches. So let's start with prayer, shall we? Well, Father, thank you so much for today. Thank you for the opportunity to share what you've placed on my heart. And Lord, I just think this is so important. And so, Father, I'm asking you today just to meet with us here today, and whether it be here as we're here live now, or whether it be listening to the recording a bit later on, whatever the case might be, Lord, I pray that it'll fall on the ears of those that could benefit from it. Lord, a lot of what I'm talking about today, I wish I would have known when I was a young pastor. I feel like it would have helped me pastor the folks that I was shepherding in a more healthy manner. And so, Father, we pray today that you will just guide us and direct us in this time, and we'll praise you for it all in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so once again today, we're talking about congregant interactions, considerations, and I want you to keep that in mind, that as we talk today, that's simply what this is a consideration. I'm not here, now I'll go into this a little bit later on, I'm not here to convince you about attachment theory, that type of thing. It is simply consideration for us to, well, consider. So considerations regarding interactive behaviors of fellow church attendees. Have you folks ever just sat back and watched people that attend church together and wonder why on earth do they interact with one another like they do? You may have those people in your church that are, you know, they want to be in the middle of everything. They need a lot of praise. They need a lot of attention. They need a lot of encouragement. And those folks can come across as clingy and needy, and they quite frankly can suck the life out of you if you're not careful. And so part of what I want to go in today is to talk a little bit more about maybe why it's that way. So let's start with some scripture. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 says this. Now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all seek the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that ye be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a church like that, that everybody was of the same mind? I remember hearing a gentleman say years ago, in fact, he started pastoring a church that I pastored for a little while, and one of the deacons dipped skull. And this pastor didn't like the fact that this deacon dipped skull. And I remember him telling me one time, you know, if I could get brother so-and-so, and I'm not going to call brother so-and-so's name, he's no longer with us, he's with the Lord. But he said, you know, if I could get brother so-and-so to stop dipping skull, he said this. He said, I would have the perfect church. Now, I was a young pastor back in those days and didn't really think that much about it. But now that I'm my age, I think, brother, if somebody dipping skull in your church is the biggest issue you got in your church, there's something going on there. My guess is there's probably deeper issues, but for whatever reason, he was focusing on the dipping of the skull. But wouldn't it be ideal if we had a church like this, where everybody, I'm not saying that everybody agreed on it, but we come together and we work for the purpose of spreading God's word. So the question then becomes, why should we take time to consider interactions between fellow congregants? Why have I put the time into putting this presentation together? I did a presentation on Monday afternoon about the benefit of pastors receiving counseling. And that's really where my heartbeat is today. That's really where my passion is working with counseling pastors, because of knowing what pastors deal with. So why should we take the time to consider interactions between fellow congregants? Well, I think, first of all, we want to increase the attempt to recognize the way congregants interact. I actually just changed the word, where the word recognize is, I had the word understand. And I hear a lot of times in couples therapy, I'll hear the wife say, I just want him to understand what I'm going through. And so I will say to her, well, what's the likelihood that he's going to understand this? Because unless you've walked in those shoes, you can't really understand it, right? For example, both of my parents are still living. And so when someone, if I'm working with somebody who has lost a parent, I can't say to them, I understand what that's like. I can sympathize with them, but I don't understand it. Pam, on the other hand, both of her parents are with the Lord. So Pam could walk up to somebody who had lost a parent and say to them, I understand what you're going through, and it would be genuine. So while we may not fully understand the stories, the backgrounds of where our people are coming from, we can certainly try to recognize it and the way that they interact with one another. Now, but why? Why do we do that? Well, here's one of the main things that I want to talk about in this workshop today. I'm hoping, I'm praying that pastors can decrease the self-blame that they sometimes experience with the way that people interact. I want to get into a couple of stories. Well, actually, this would be a good place to share my first story. And these guys that I've worked with, I contacted them and I said, hey, I'm doing a couple of presentations at our convention in a few days, and I may use some of your story if I can. And they all gave me their blessing to do so. Just the other day, I was working with a young pastor who pastors in our area, not of our denomination. I've been working with his wife and him for quite some time. Quite honestly, here's what I see. When I'm working with pastors, typically what I see is it falls in three categories. A lot of what I see with pastors is just simply discouragement or depression or what's oftentimes called burnout today. This part is not in my notes, but let me just say something, okay? I think there are terms that we use today that are overused. I think the term burnout is overused. But to be burned out means I have absolutely nothing left to give. And I think a lot of times folks feel that way until we sort of dig down through, we process through, and when we get down to what they're really experiencing, then we find out there is still energy there. It's just covered and buried down beneath so much of this stuff. Another term that's way, way, way overused today is the term narcissist. There's actually very few narcissists in this world. But everybody, if you understand the criteria of narcissistic personality disorder, there's really very few out there. There's a very small percentage. There are a lot of self-centered people, but that does not make someone a narcissist. Depression, we use the term depression a lot. And I love if you sat in on Neil Gilliland's workshop yesterday. He was talking about looking through the windows of grief and talking about dysthymia. And dysthymia, as he pointed out, is not being way down so depressed that you can't get out of bed. It's just being sad. And in order to be diagnosed with persistent, what used to be called persistent depressive disorder, or now dysthymia, is a person has to be in that condition for 2 years. And if there's been a period of 2 months or more that they were not in that condition, then that takes away from that, and then it's major depressive disorder. But we just because we feel sad doesn't mean we feel depressed. Now, why is that a big deal? Because I hear people say to me, "I'm depressed." Well, depression has a negative connotation to it. Depression has a mental health disorder connotation to it. To say I'm sad lets me feel what I'm feeling without thinking there's something wrong with me. Bipolar. We call everybody that has mood fluctuations, we call that bipolar. That's not bipolar, that's being human being. As human beings, our moods are going to fluctuate. Somehow or another, in our Americanized Christianity, we've just bought into this idea that we're never supposed to be sad. Well, that's not true. Our moods are going to go up and down. It depends on what we do with that. So those are just some terms that I think that are way overused. So we may not fully understand where our congregants are coming from, but I do think that we can help try to recognize maybe where they are. And I think once we do that, then we're able to decrease the self-blame. So back to this young pastor that I was talking to. He's doing a great work. I so appreciate the work. I love his heart for the kingdom. I love his wife's heart for the kingdom. But what I typically see with pastors when I'm working with pastors is I typically just see a lot of discouragement. A lot of them that just feel like they're beating their head against the wall and they're doing all the things. They've read the books. They've attended the workshops. They're doing all of these things to try to reach people, and there's just not a lot happening. Second thing that I see with pastors is that the church might be growing, but there's no connection at home. That's a common one that I see. Is that and oftentimes the pastor is pouring himself so much into what he's doing that the wife can feel neglected. And so there's not the connection at home, and I do a lot of work with pastors in that. And then the third area that I see with pastors, unfortunately, is what I would call compulsivity, which is they're maybe doing some things that are not healthy, maybe indeed sinful, in ways to cope, and those are things that we certainly want to address. So not only do we want to decrease pastoral self-blame, but increase potential patience toward those whose interactions lie beyond that which seems Christ-like. Now, again, and I'm going to go into this in more detail in a few moments, but it is not my objective today to say that sinful behavior of people is something that we just want to overlook. We don't want to hold them accountable. Absolutely, I'm not saying that at all. But here is what I would say, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it anyway. I don't think that every issue that people has can necessarily be attributed to sin itself. Now, let me hasten to say, yes, we're all sinful. We live in a sin-cursed world. And yes, because of the fall of Adam and Eve, these things happen. But I'm not one that looks at somebody and says, that's going on because there's some sort of unconfessed sin in your life. Now, that might be, but I don't think that it always is. Now, I do think that some people's experiences can lead them towards sinful behavior. In other words, if they're medicating, let's say they're using pornography or something like that, then we're going to look at that and we say, look, that's sinful behavior that we shouldn't be engaged in. But once when I recognize that human behavior, in my opinion, often comes as a result of woundedness and brokenness, then I can be more patient with those folks. And so that's my objective today. And then hopefully through all of this, decrease frustration with congregants. And why is that? Well, the reason that I want to talk about this with pastors is because, as I spoke about in my workshop on Monday, according to some research done recently by Barna, they found out, and this was done in, I think, March of 2022. This is a very recent research that they've done. They surveyed pastors and found out that in the last year, 42% of the pastors they surveyed that are full-time pastors have considered getting out of the ministry within the last year. That's 42%. And right now, we are in our denomination, we're talking about maybe the need to begin to merge congregations together. Now, that sounds good on paper, and actually the second church that I pastored was one where I was the second pastor of that church. It split, and then they half the congregation wanted me to leave and half the congregation wanted me to stay, but the half that wanted me to leave got together and had their own meeting and voted to. Now, if I had the experience that I have today, I would have handled it differently. But I chose to resign, and then not long after that, the church split. Well, then a few months later, the split asked me to come and pastor them. And I did, and I don't know, we were there for 2, 3, 4 years, something like that. And so I was going to, I was feeling the lead to go be a church planter, which is what has been the most of our, Pam's and my ministry, to the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. We moved there in 1995, working with back then Home Missions, today North American Ministries, to start churches. But we merged those two churches back together. We took the original church, we took the split, and we merged those two churches back together. And then Pam and I moved to Nashville so I could attend Bible college before moving on to the Pittsburgh area to start those churches. And we started a couple of churches there in the Pittsburgh region. So when we start joining these congregations back together, there's going to be some folks that don't like that very well. There's going to be some folks that's going to upset their apple cart. I think part of what we sometimes get out of our mind is that not everybody that goes to church because of kingdom work of God, right? Some folks go to that church because they've gone there for years and years and years, and they like it, and you come in and you start messing with things, now we're going to get upset. So the reason that I'm hoping this will help pastors decrease frustration with congregants is because a lot of times when I'm working with people in a session and I hear them use the word need, I'll say, no, is it a need or is it a want? Because what we need is food, water, and air. But I think it is important in our movement that pastors develop longevity in staying in the ministry and staying in the pastorate. And I'm happy to say today that, and Dr. Moody alluded to this yesterday in his presentation, that our pastors are staying longer. I remember when I lived in Northwest Arkansas, there were Free Will Baptist churches dotted around everywhere. And, you could pastor 5 or 6 different churches and never pack a box, because every one of those churches within driving distance. And so, a guy would go to a church and he'd stay there for a year or two and then he'd move to the next church. And I've literally seen some guys make the entire circuit. Well, I'm happy to say that that's not the case. It's not like it used to be, as far as I know, in most places. But if part of it is pastors working through and processing through the frustrations they experience, and that's part of what I like to do as a counselor in working with those pastors. And just because a pastor is talking to me doesn't mean he's in some sort of psychotic state. I think sometimes people think we only talk to licensed professional counselors if we're crazy. Well, that's not the case at all. And I tell folks all the time, I'm no smarter than them. I'm just there to help them process through. I had a pastor that reached out to me, a couple of years ago, I guess, and not in our denomination. And he said to me, he said, you know, Tom, he said, I don't think I have any mental health disorders. He said, I don't really think I have anything going on. He said, I've just become the senior pastor of this church, and his dad, I don't know if his dad started the church, but his dad was a very influential individual. He was the pastor there for many years. And this guy said to me, and he was in his 30s, he said to me, he said, Tom, he said, I want to retire here. He said, I got a lot of years ahead of me. He said, I just want to check in and make sure everything's okay. So he and I just do some check-ins every once in a while, which I think is amazing. I quite frankly wish all pastors would do that. Just kind of do a check-in every once in a while. And what they'll say to me is, Tom, just let me know if you hear something that's concerning to you. I love that. So if we decrease the frustration that we as pastors experience, then that can hopefully help us stay longer in our position. Now, I'm about to play a video. There's not very many of us in here, so you should be able to hear this pretty well. This is actually a video that I use with couples therapy. Probably, maybe that all of you in here have seen this. I don't know. Hopefully, you'll be able to hear it okay. I'm going to be really quiet while it's playing. Hopefully, you'll be able to hear it. All right, I don't know how well you could hear that, and you couldn't hear it very well. How many of you have seen that? How many of you have seen that video before? It's called It's Not About the Nail. What I would encourage you to do, if you couldn't hear it very well, I would encourage you to go back and listen to it sometime. The premise of this is, now that's that, and that's a humorous, over-the-top presentation. Pam, quite frankly, doesn't like that particular video. So the premise of this video is this woman's talking about the pain that she has, just this pain in her head, and you can't see it. She said she doesn't think it's going to stop, and then she turns, and there's a nail sticking in her forehead. And the man says to her, well, you do have a nail in your forehead. And she said, it's not about the nail. And he said, I think it is about the nail. And so her thought is, well, stop trying to fix me because it's, and he said, well, I think it is if we need to get that out of there. And then he listens to her and she's talking to him and he said, that must be really hard. And in that moment then, she felt loved. Now, just real quickly, how many of you here would be more like the man? Just get the nail out of your head. How many of us would be like the woman that talked to me about the nail before you try to pull the nail out? I may be the only one. I'm in that crowd. I'm the woman in that video. Because I see what I do is if I have a nail in my head. Now, obviously that's over the top because obviously. Now, look, if we have a real nail in our head, then obviously the main thing is go get that nail out. But that's an illustration. Because what we do is we have woundedness in our life. And if I'm not careful, when Pam is wanting to help me with that nail, what I am hearing her say is, well, here you go. You went and got another nail in your head I got to help you pull out. Now, that's not what she's saying, but that's what I'm hearing. Because what I want to know is that even with this nail in my head, you can still love me. That you don't see that there's something wrong with me. Because I grew up believing that there was something wrong with me. You see what I'm talking about? When I was a small child, I don't know that I was completely sexually abused, but I do remember a boy in our neighborhood when I lived in up by the Kansas City area who exposed himself and said some things to me. And the last thing I remember is coiling and turning away and saying no. And then it's literally just like if I just turned the screen off and it went blank. I have no memory past that. So I don't know what happened. But I can tell you this. that I spent many, many years of my life believing that there was something wrong with me. And so then I have tried to prove myself to people that either I'm likable way back a long time ago, I learned how to laugh, and I had a loud laugh, and people kind of wanted to be around that, and so it made me, I thought it made me acceptable. And so that's how I interact with people a lot. And I shared with Dr. Moody when we did the podcast about what we're doing to help pastors. I said to him, Dr. Moody, people would have seen me, say, at the national convention or whatever. Everybody would have thought I was doing fine because I was laughing, I was cutting up, I was carrying on. But oftentimes I was crying on the inside. And I was laughing to keep from crying. Because nobody wants to be around the guy that's crying all the time. They want to be around the guy that's laughing all the time. So the video is kind of a humorous, over-the-top presentation, but why is there such a difference in viewpoints? Well, there's something I want us to remember. Every person that comes into your church has a story. I describe myself as an extrovert on steroids. I don't know if that's actually accurate. It kind of depends on the setting. For example, Pam is a real estate agent. When we go to her Christmas party, and there's real estate agents all around, and I don't know real estate language. I now know what it means when a house has good bones. That means that it's structurally sound. And I will forget the first Pam said, that house has good bones. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Well, it means it's structurally sound. But when we're around all of these real estate agents and I don't know them, I find myself sort of calling back and being a little more introverted. So I don't know, maybe I'm more of an introvert than I realize. Maybe I've just convinced myself that I am an extrovert on steroids. But I do say this, that people, to me, there's no such thing as a stranger. There's just simply stories that I haven't heard yet. And I love hearing people's stories. I've often said that if you're flying on an airplane, I'm not the guy. If you're a person that wants to read a book and sit in silence, I'm not the guy you want sitting beside you on that plane. Because if I get a chance, I want to chat with you. I want to talk. I was telling Pam the other day, I'm a word guy. I like words. I like to hear words. I like to read words. Because words, if you take the time to engage with me in conversation, that says to me that you see me as valuable. Every congregant has a story. Some stories produce positive results, while some produce negative results. And a lot of times when folks walk into our churches, they already kind of have an idea of what they might be facing when they come in there. Especially if it's people that have had negative experiences in churches in the past, they're going to come in on guard. They're going to come in, sometimes they're going to come in being a little withdrawn because they already have something in their mind that they're going to experience, they're going to deal with. So, and I'm not saying that we have to know every detail of people's stories to be able to work with them, but there's a lot of people that are interested in us hearing their story because of the fact that when we hear them, that says to them that we value them. And so my point behind that is that we want to be careful that we don't, that just because somebody's attachment style or their ways of interacting is different to us or maybe even uncomfortable for us, we want to be careful that we're moving toward them rather than moving away from them. I'm big on love languages. The five love languages. I like that. I don't think it goes deep enough, but I like the love languages. But here's something that I work with a lot with couples. When for example, my primary love language, this might surprise you, but my primary love language is words of affirmation. That's probably Pam's least likely love language. And here's why. Because it feels fake to her. And Pam doesn't do fake well. And so it was easy for me for her to do all of these things. One of Pam's primary love languages is acts of service. That, however, really doesn't speak love to me that much. But I would oftentimes be convinced that Pam didn't love me as much because she wasn't speaking to me in words of affirmation. And she would say to me, Tom, how can you say I don't love you? Look at all these things that I do for you. But that in itself didn't feel loving to me. So it's uncomfortable for her. Another pastor that I work with, just the other day, he and I were talking. He said, I told him, I said, can I share this story? And he said, yeah. I said, I won't use your name. He said, Tom, I don't care. You tell him who I am. You tell him where I live. He said, I am an open book. I don't care. But he came from an area, he come from a life of drug addiction. He got saved in the, the Assemblies of God, what they do to help with drugs. What's it called? Teen Challenge. Yes, thank you. He got saved through Teen Challenge and really has a burden to work with people in that area. But one of the ways, so to him, he has experienced a lot of abandonment in life. He and his wife just had their fourth child not that long ago, and this baby cries all the time. And so I work with him and his wife, and so she often feels like she's not a very good mom because she's not getting things done. Her house doesn't look like she would want her house to look if her mom showed up. And so she feels like she's a bad mom. Well, he comes home at the end of the day, and he grabs a broom, and he starts sweeping the floor. Well, in his mind, I'm showing this woman love. And she looks at him and she said, why are you sweeping the floor? What message did that send to her? The message that sent to her is, you're not keeping a clean house. And so now, after me working all day, I got to come home and clean this house. She's the woman with the nail in her head. What she wants to do is come home, and even while the baby's crying, he wants to look at her. She wants him to look at her and say, honey, I know this is hard, but you're doing a great job as a mom. That would bring all kinds of encouragement to her. But to him, that feels fake. And so he goes and he wants to take the baby to give her some relief. Well, what message does that send to her? You're not a good mom. Let me take care of this baby. And so they're struggling because they're both trying to love one another, but they're not doing it in one another's love language. And I say to him, so what does that say to you? Well, she doesn't care about me. And I say to her, what does that say to you? Well, he doesn't care about me. So I look at him and I say, why do you stop loving her when you come home at night? He said, I don't stop loving her when I come home at night. I said to her, why don't you? Because what he wants her to do, because he's in a highly stressed position in his pastorate, he wants her to look at him when he walks in the door and see him and see his pain and smile at him as if to say, I still love you. But that to her, she's got four kids. Like, what, are you kidding me? I'm going to smile at you when you are. Do you not know what I've been going? But now listen, why some of this may sound silly to some of us, this is what everyday people live with. And so I said to her, well, why don't you love him enough to, why do you stop loving him when he comes home? And she said, I don't stop loving him. And I said to her, well, why do you stop loving her when you start sweeping the floor? He said, I'm not stopping loving her. I'm trying to show I am loving her. So I've said to both of them, because to her, the words of affirmation don't come easily. And her looking at him and smiling, that's the last thing she's thinking when he walks in the door. And so what I've talked to both of them about is, how do you show one another love in the other one's language? And here's what I found out. I recognize this. That for me to show love in Pam's love language does not lie within my comfort zone, and vice versa. Oftentimes, when we're loving people in a way that connects with them, it will be outside of our comfort zone. And while we are aware of what we are wanting, oftentimes we're not aware of what our spouse or maybe what our congregants want. Talking to another gentleman who... He's a pastor that loves to embrace people. He loves to, that's part of his way of showing love. He wants to be able to connect with people, but there are people that pull away from that. And when some of those people pull away from that, then he feels like he's being a pastor in some way, when in reality, they're just not comfortable with it. But we often try to show love the way that feels loving to us. So my point being that it depends on people's story of what happens with that. Some stories produce lenses through which life is viewed. I have an illustration, but I'm not going to use it here today. I used it the other day. So Let's imagine, I see that there's two of you in here today that are wearing glasses, and I'm not trying to bring attention to that. I wear one contact. I do what's called monovision. I wear a contact in my left eye. And I did it because I got tired of when I was preaching. If I looked down at my Bible, I couldn't see it. When I looked up the congregation, I could see them fine. So I was constantly taking these glasses off. And my mom told me about her eye doctor, told her about monovision. And so I do that now. So what I do is when I look down, I automatically focus with my left eye. I don't even have to, my brain has finally been trained to do that. When I look up, I focus with my right eye. If I do that, you guys are all blurry. If I do that, you're perfectly clear. Now, let's say that Steve back there comes up to me and he takes his glasses off and he puts them on me. How is that going to impact how I'm seeing things? I'm going to be seeing the exact same things, but now it's going to change how I see them because he has put those lenses on me. You follow what I'm saying? So stories put lenses on us through which we see life. Now, sometimes, and I'll get into this a little bit more in just a moment, this can happen all the way back when we're small children. I believe what happened to me in the backyard that day, and I don't know fully what happened to me, but I believe that put a lens on me that I started seeing myself through. Let me tell you something. I've done enough work with people that have been sexually abused that I know that it skews all of them that I've worked with. Of course, they're obviously coming in for mental help or they wouldn't be coming to see me. But it just does something to the thought patterns. People will often ask me, Tom, how do you sit with people all day like that? And I'll do 30 to 35 appointments per week, and they'll ask me, they say, Tom, how do you not carry that with you? And I'll say something along the line of, well, I learned early on that it doesn't help them if I hold on to that stuff. And it certainly doesn't help me. But when sessions come back to my mind that hit me and I may be doing some sort of mindless type thing, like riding my lawnmower, cutting my grass, the thoughts that will be on my mind about a counseling session very often will be the ones that somebody's told me about sex abuse. Those are the ones that tend to stick with me. So these stories produce lenses through which life can be viewed. So let's talk for just a moment. We got about 10 more minutes here. We're going to talk just for a few minutes about consider the difference between personality versus attachment style. So personality comes from the Latin word persona or mask. So it's the character that actor would take on behind that mask. And I'm kind of rushing through this a little bit. So it's commonly considered a person's personality is often considered to be part of their DNA makeup and with which he or she was born. I remember doing a couples workshop one time and I pointed out something, and I heard the husband say, "See there, honey, it's my personality. I can't help it." Well, that's kind of the problem, and that's really not, in my opinion, what personality. See, I don't believe people are born with a personality. And we say this in the world of psychology. There's a lot in the world of psychology that's not agreed upon, but one of the main things that agreed upon is this. That we are born genetically with certain temperaments, but it's our climate and our temperament combined that develops our personality. And I think this is part of what drives couples apart. I think this is part of what drives churches apart, is we just tend to think, well, this is just who I am and I can't do anything about it. You're either going to learn to love me or you're not. I don't agree with that. I think it can be changed. I think it can be different. All right, so let's move on here. Sometimes then, personality is used to redirect culpability. In other words, it's not my fault, it's just my personality. You want me to be attached to you, but you want me to be all romantic. That's not my personality. You can change that. It can be changed. All right, so let's move on. But what about attachment? So attachment theory was started by John Bowlby back in 1958. So when it comes to attachment, people either have, according to attachment theory, people either have a secure attachment style or they have an insecure attachment style. They tell us, and I think those of us who are counselors might find this a little bit hard to believe, they tell us that about 60% of the population have secure attachment styles. And I think we as counselors find that hard to believe because we work with so many people that have insecure attachment styles, but that's because they're coming to, most people don't pay a counselor to go and say, hey, everything's going good, we just want you to know we're doing so good, we just can't stand it, so we're just in here talking to you. That's not typically the case. So either secure or you have an insecure attachment style. Insecure shows up in three categories. And I'm not trying to give you too much theory here, but just kind of how it breaks down. So some people have what we call an ambivalent, an ambivalent anxious attachment style. Those are the folks that are very needy and very clingy, and they would like to have a lot of affirmation, and they want a lot of pats on the back, and they want to be seen, they want to be recognized for what they do. And then you have the avoidant attachment style. And they're the one that they're going to kind of stay aloof. They're going to stay a little bit more distant. They're not going to get that much caught up in things. And if you start getting too emotional around them, they don't like that. They pull away from that. And then there's what's called a disorganized attachment style. And that person's all over the place. Those are the ones that typically in counseling sessions that I do, a lot of times when we talk about borderline personality disorder, those are the ones that a lot of times I would say fall in that category. So what determines? So basically, attachment theory is built on two questions. Number one, am I lovable? Number two, can I depend on you to help me feel loved? So if I answer yes to both of those questions, that means I feel comfortable being by myself, or I feel comfortable being around other people. That's the secure attachment style. If I say I'm not lovable, but yes, I can depend on you to help me feel loved, that's the anxious or the fearful category. Because those are the ones that, see, I don't feel good about myself, but if you will feel good about me, then I can feel good about myself. Those are often people pleasers. They will do whatever they can. And these are the folks in your church that they will do everything they can until they're not getting recognized, and then they're angry because nobody's seeing what they're doing and they're ready to leave. And you will run across those folks. Some people will answer, yes, I'm lovable, but no, I can't depend on others. That's called an avoidant personality, or avoidant attachment style, rather. So yes, I believe I'm lovable. I believe down deep in my heart I'm lovable, but I don't trust people. I don't know what to do with these emotions. And they may be people that were taught that emotions were bad when they were growing up. They may have been gotten onto when they cried. They may have been told not to be emotional, and they don't know what to do with it. Listen, it's not that they don't want to. They don't know how. And so these people that are clinging to that, and sometimes you say, oh, I just need some space. There's a reason why they're doing that. They're scared. They're afraid that you won't like them. They're afraid that you'll give up on them. And I hear this in counseling a lot. Don't give up on me. Don't quit trying. And I try to assure them and remind them that I'm not going to do that. Well, oh, and by the way, so if you answer no to both of those questions, no, I'm not lovable, no, I can't depend on others, that puts us in what's called a disorganized. And there's a book I'm going to share with you in just a couple of moments called Why You Do the Things You Do. That in that book, they call those people, they say that those people see the grass as dead on both sides of the fence. I'm just kind of giving you the very basics here. So our attachment style then impacts the individual's view of self and others. And I think this is what drives people to interact with one another like they do. All right, so this presentation is intended for consideration, and really for consideration only, rather than an attempt to convince you or others about attachment theory. It is simply a reminder that human behavior is both fascinating and complex. I absolutely love it. This presentation is not intended to be an attempt to dismiss sin and our responsibility. This is not an attempt to dismiss responsibility for sinful behavior. It is a simple reminder to see people through eyes of compassion and to understand that human behavior is not a reflection of pastoral abilities. Folks, they come with those thoughts in church in their mind before they ever meet you as a pastor. So your pastoring ability is not why these folks are experiencing what they're experiencing. So then I was talking recently to a young pastor who was lamenting because of some people that he had seen one to the Lord. He had discipled them, he had baptized them, and there's a couple of them that just aren't living for the Lord. So he began to question his ability as a pastor because these folks, and so we talked about this. Behold, a sower went forth to sow, and when he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. Some fell upon the stony places where they had not much earth, and forthwith they sprung up because they had no deepness of earth. And when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away, and some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprung up and choked them. But other fell into good ground and brought forth fruit, some 100-fold, some 60-fold, some 30-fold. I'm going to put this up on the screen. You can, if you're interested in it, take a picture of it, write it down or whatever. If you want to find out your attachment style, if you want to find out your spouse's attachment style, if you want to find a way to help understand the attachment styles of folks in your church, just simply go to the website called AuthenticHappiness.com. It'll take you to the University of Pennsylvania's website. You want to scroll down all the way down to the bottom of the page and click on questionnaires. And then when that brings that up, scroll back down again and find close relationship questionnaires. And there'll be a place there to click on take the test. Now, when you click on that, you will have to create an account. It doesn't cost you anything. You won't receive anything from them. I've never received anything from them. The people that I've given this to has never received anything from them. It's a safe place to do this. It's free of charge. It doesn't cost you anything. But it will show you what your attachment style is. It'll even give you what people in your area, your age group, it's really fascinating. If you like this kind of thing, I really do think you'll find it very fascinating. So, but you can go there and you can find that. Now, let me show you this book. This is a book that I highly recommend. I encourage every young pastor that every pastor that I work with to read this book. It's called Why You Do the Things You Do. It's Why You Do the Things You Do, The Secret to Healthy Relationships. It's written by Dr. Tim Clinton, who's the president of the American Association of Christian Counselors, and Dr. Gary Sibsey, who used to be, he's a Christian psychologist. He used to be an adjunct professor at Liberty University's a professional counseling program. I don't know if he still does that or not. This book is about what I've talked to you about here today. It's about attachment theory from a Christian perspective. You will see yourself in this book. You'll see your spouse in this book. You will see members of your congregation in this book. This is a book that I highly recommend you read. So, what's my purpose in giving this presentation today? My purpose is for us to be long-suffering with the people that we work with, and hopefully to help pastors be able to stay even in the midst of the frustrations.